I'm officially set to direct a comedy now, and I was reaching out to the producers to ask what I'm able to discuss if anyone were interested, not in any way, shape, or form suggesting you should be or might be. But I just needed them, you know, we're so early in the process that I didn't know at what liberty I was. And now after reading that on your website, I do. So, how is everyone?
Right.
Great.
Fantastic. Who's seen the film?
We all have.
Yeah. Even better. Why didn't you like it? Oh, sorry.
Well, I'll tell you what I did like, and
please.
I'm wondering if it was on purpose. You didn't go back to show clips of anybody's act. Mm. Even when you talk about Mitch, you know, some people probably know him, don't know him by name. Was that just because you had so much material otherwise to use, or you didn't want to go there?
Great question, because it was one that's hasn't been asked much, and it was such a point of contention between my producers and I. They really wanted clips of people's act. I just feel we've seen that. What we haven't seen is what I attempted to do with the film, which is what it really takes to do this, what it really means to put in the 10,000 hours, what ultimately became the chapters. The initial thesis, you have to be miserable to be funny, became the third act. First two acts being, again, getting to know these people and why do they choose this life and what happened along the way. So the idea of stopping during that discussion and showing a clip of somebody's act seemed like it would be a parlor trick just to entertain and would have nothing to do with what I felt. If the film accomplished anything, it would be the opposite of someone's act.
Yeah.
As truthful as anyone's act might be, it's still a heightened reality.
No, it makes sense, because like the chat show that you do, it's one of the rare things where you can see someone basically almost uninterrupted go for, you know, an hour, 2 hours.
In the case of Tom Hanks, 2 hours and 42 minutes. No, the idea is to break them down.
Yeah.
Break
their
spirit and have them speak honestly and truthfully the way they never get a chance to.
Yeah, no, I remember in the early days, like Kevin Smith and Jason Reitman, and it's just interesting when they can sort of expand, and they almost seem to be waiting for to be interrupted, but you don't, and the story gets more interested. And I'm just curious if doing the chat show was maybe like a spark to do this, like knowing...
More than a spark.
Yeah.
No, it's the only reason it made sense to the producers for me to do it. Because I had at that point 5 years, and now a little more than six of getting any interview skills, and then also equally, if not more important, the ability to book people. Mm. You know, I booked the chat show myself now over 6 years, and booked everyone in the film. And you know, casting is what makes every film happen ultimately. This next one I'm allegedly directing, you know, they're all cast contingent. So in this case, I knew that the information available would rest solely on the subject. And even in answering the question, why am I not on camera, why am I not heard more in the film, while I have respect for Michael Moore and Mr. Spurlock, it just felt too self-serving. And, you know, I edited the film, so the film is my opinion. I had 70 hours of stories and material to choose 94 minutes from. So by making those selections, I formed my opinion on the subject. And I just had such amazing people and who I was fortunate enough to get that the idea of stopping to show clips or stopping to show myself seemed not at all on subject, on point.
Just since you mentioned the editing, like what's that like? Because you can tell sometimes it seems like someone's like, you know, on their third or fourth thought, and that's the one you keyed in. Like for Kevin Smith, he's talking about his friend doing a podcast. Like,
see, him and Freddie Prinze Jr. and even Penn Jillette were the toughest, because, especially with Kevin and Penn, they're famous for not speaking in answers or sentences.
I've interviewed them both.
Yes.
So it was really impossible, quite frankly. And it took 10 months to cut this film. And I would have continued cutting if not for the Sundance Film Festival deadline, where they insisted on having a locked print. So, because, you know, there was no script, no narrative, no story when I started. I had a two-time Academy Award winner in Robert Legato help me create a 10-minute template before I lost him as an editor. And then he showed me the basic Adobe Premiere cut buttons to hit, and I went into the vacuum on my own and cut the film, and then brought in great editor Dylan King for finesse work with the chapters and transitions. But yeah, that crafting of that 94 minutes in terms of making those hard decisions as to who stayed and who didn't and for how long was an impossible task that, like circumventing the waters of your career or life, there's no correct path, just the one you choose. So ultimately, what you see is the one that I was stopped from changing yet again.
Were there pieces that stuck out that didn't make the cut?
Yeah. And not revelation, mm-hmm. revelatory pieces or moments, but just, yeah, I mean, you know. It blew up to 2 hours at one point, and because I didn't want to not include anything powerful or overly hilarious. And then, you know, I just, you don't have a choice, and so, yeah, of course.
Were you surprised by anybody's confessions?
I was surprised by most of it. I mean, you know, the reason John Barhouse is listed as one of the writers is because he contributed a portion of the questions that I asked. But there were, you know, 40 to 50 questions that I asked in total. I maybe only had time to ask 10, 15, 20 to any one person in the hour or whatever we got on average with each person's time. So those questions had to be really carefully considered and crafted and timed. One thing I learned from the chat show was how to warm people up a little before you come in for the kill, as it were. But it's funny, like in the case of Freddie Prinze Jr., I'd known him from the beginning of his career, at a turning point in his career when he did She's All That. But it was the moment in time when he became a movie star. Prior to that, seeing him in The House of Yes, where he's a brilliant dramatic actor in this little tiny movie with Parker Posey, amazing film. And so his father meant something to me when I started out in stand-up, and then he shared with me when he was 11, he and his friend had memorized my first HBO special, and he in fact proved it by reciting it back to me. And so when I reached out to him, I had to ask if he was ready to talk about his father on camera for the very first time, but I had no expectation. So when he said yes, I found myself, when asking the questions, also wanting to protect him from saying too much in a weird way. And I had to get out of my own way during that process. And then in editing, a choice of what to include and what not to, and what to hint at. You know, so there was a lot that I just couldn't get into the film. Is that the question?
Yeah. Okay. Were there comics that you wanted to talk to who just weren't available?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I dedicate the film to Robin Williams because not only was he a close friend and a mentor since I started the San Francisco stand-up comedy at the age of 20, had been incredibly generous to me over the years, appearing in one of my HBO specials in this funny sketch where I'm learning how to do impressions into a mirror, and I'm doing him. Whoa, down Mr. Happy. Oh, that's not it. Shit. Whoa, don't be frightened. Her. No, that's not it. Shit, how'd you do it? And the camera widens out and he's standing right there. And he shows me then how to do that. So he's incredibly generous over the years. And in fact, when I was shooting, he was one of the people that just wasn't available because of scheduling. He was doing the TV show at the time. I had 4 consecutive 5-day weeks. He was shooting all those 4 consecutive 5-day weeks every day, 12, 14-hour days on the TV show, single camera comedy. You don't really get any time or breaks. But he got on the phone with me twice, almost an hour each time. And I felt he was sort of using that time to talk about the subject, to talk about the film, to talk about its importance, to talk about what it means to articulate misery on stage and as a performer. And so when he passed when I was editing, it became a no-brainer to dedicate the film to him. But, you know, I knew I wouldn't get the 4 comics who appeared in the HBO Sit Down, Ricky Gervais, Chris Rock, Jerry Seinfeld, and Louis C.K., because they had already kind of done it. Jerry even emailed me and said, I'm pretty talked out on comedy, given his own documentary, and then, of course, Coffee with Comics and Cars.
Yeah.
you know, but mostly it was a scheduling issue for a lot of people. And when we started shooting, we had 25 people locked in. I booked everyone, as I said, and whoever was available is who we got. And then people kept saying yes during those 4 weeks. We kept slotting them in until ultimately we had over 60. So that was an insane good fortune. And yeah, there's always going to be stuff you didn't get to.
I don't want to harp on the fact about editing again, but what I was also really interested in was, besides Bob Saget, the film opened up with people who aren't traditionally stand-ups in people's eyes. It was Christopher Guest, it was Jason Reitman. You know, was there any specific reason why you kind of just decided, it's just because of what they said that kind of opened up the film that way, or it just didn't want to kind of focus straight on stand-up?
There was no concentrated effort to avoid comedians, stand-ups, pure stand-ups, in the opening of the film. It really was about creating a quick introduction to the subject matter. And that had to do with Robert Legato and helping to carve the initial 10-minute template, which we brought to 2014 Sundance for the production company to sort of show potential financiers. And thankfully they asked for this, because it gave some sort of continuity to what we were attempting to accomplish. So he had started that template with that sort of rapid fire opening thing. And when I opened up the template on my own, it still made sense to keep a lot of those people in that opening. And it never crossed my mind until just now that pure stand-ups had been left out. It really was a matter of flow. And also, once I decided to include non-stand-ups in the piece, then that no longer became germane to any decisions and storytelling as to staying with pure stand-ups for any particular section. And the notion there, you know, do you have to be miserable to be funny becomes the third act. First two acts, getting to know these people and their travels. And once I decided that, I realized that having non-comedians, but storytellers, be them filmmakers or otherwise considered dramatic actors, William H. Macy, Sam Rockwell, Bobby Cannavale, they've all done comedy, but they've all done it live on stage, and that was what made me want to include them. Because even when I saw Sam Rockwell, A Behanding in Spokane on Broadway, he's got a monologue that he does in one to the audience. So you just know what it's like to stand on stage naked and try to elicit laughter from strangers. And again, those first two acts become about who chooses this life. And then so I wanted to open it up to the type of person that chooses entertaining others and the vulnerability needed and the devotion of one's life to rejection, ultimately, on an ongoing basis that never ends. Certainly the sense memory of it is at the ready, and the potential for it at any given moment, including right now, is available. And that's in the performer's mind. So it didn't have to be just stand-ups anymore. It had to be about creative, funny people. In the case of Bobby Cannavale, for example, I know how funny he is. I know if I can get him to sit down and talk at all about the pursuit, I would get funny. I would get insight. Thankfully, I was right. And you know, and Jimmy Fallon had just finished, sometimes on Thursdays, talk shows, do two shows back to back to take Friday off. He had just finished two shows back to back before he sat down with us for an hour and a half. It was ridiculous. Truly. And also just to give some of the better insights in terms of it being a drug and what it really means and how we collective move to one part of the party as a group. So yeah.
So you mentioned the film being your opinion, but obviously you've been a comic long before you made the film. So was your opinion on the subject matter drastically altered by doing the film?
Did you? It was informed. Mm-hmm. It was drastically informed. certainly of the bigger picture here. You know, we tend to fall into a vacuum, and as solo performers, and one of the moments where I did include my own voice was when I'm talking about how war stories, not from sharing a foxhole, but rather from a sniper, and you see that turn in Greg Proops's face, who's so articulate and intelligent that he's named his own podcast the smartest man in the world. and you see that turn on his face from a person listening to a person who dialed in an instant to the truth. You know, it was important for me ultimately to learn from everybody else's views on it the way that the audience would. One of the reasons I also took myself out of it, so that I could be the audience, so that when I got to editing, I could look at it and think of what was relevant and the flow from the audience's standpoint. So as the audience, I'm learning about these individuals all throughout the interviews, becoming drastically informed. Yeah. Because, you know, it turns out we are just snowflakes. And there is no correct way to do it, just the one we choose. And all these people chose their own path, suffered their own misery, found a way to articulate it or not. And they're so different from each other. So if there's any connective tissue along the way, then we see, oh, okay, so the profession binds them. Their experiences are going to be completely different. And then that's true to any profession. But the artists, you know, the task is to articulate the journey. And so I had a feeling going in that I would certainly learn a lot more based on how other people felt than how I felt and what I experienced.
Did you ask yourself some of the same questions that you were asking the comics? Like, who did you find to be the first person you found was funny in life and stuff like that?
Well, having done enough of these over the years, mm-hmm. I knew how I felt about most of these answers before I asked them, yeah.
Who did you find was the first person to be funny in your life?
Professionally or not?
Non-professionally.
Non-professionally. My cousin Jerry Rosenberg.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
When was that?
I was probably 5 years old. Very funny. And, you know, I wasn't from a family of funny people. Mm-hmm. So I had to go outside the nucleus to the cousins to finally find someone who was funny. But it was just a general ease with himself and with his take on life mm-hmm. that I think grabbed my attention. And then ultimately that became why I collected comedians the way my friends collected baseball cards, from the different point of views. That's any artist's task, is to find their point of view, their voice. And he was the first person who had a humorous voice.
I heard a rumor that you're going to direct a comedy. I don't know if you can say anything about that.
Hot off the presses?
Yeah. I can't confirm who told me.
Yes, I am.
Ah, there we go.
There it is.
Yeah, you know, so Misery Loves Comedy dropped on iTunes. In just a couple of days, rose to number one of all documentaries on iTunes, which is fucking amazing and shocking.
Woo-hoo. Oh, all the other ones are about the Holocaust. So,
yeah.
Thankfully. Or Stephen Queen.
Yeah.
just getting into Sundance was, I think, a bit of a goal line of unparalleled hopeful success actually happening. Selling to Tribeca Films the morning of its world premiere on Main Street at the Egyptian Theater, where it all started, where the film festival all started, was the second part of that. And because I'd been developing my own script, I knew I could go back to doing that, and in fact started developing that immediately with The moment you get into Sundance, that just becomes a calling card that first-time directors get to carry around, and people are going to give you shit or they won't. Selling your film, also that crazy calling card. Getting the second push at Tribeca Film Festival was extraordinary. And then the first time my agent called and said, there's this film that we were looking into for you as an actor. And they called back and said they heard such great things at Sundance about your film, and they need a director. Would you read the script and tell them, go in and take a meeting on it? So the fact that that happened from the so-called buzz from the Sundance experience became the third ridiculous thing, unexpected and unparalleled. And so, yeah, so now that's led to me agreeing, them agreeing on my take, and them hiring me, and we just are beginning to allow me to do a little quick rewrite, polish, as it's called, in the business. In my business, I think you know what I mean. And so I'm unbelievably excited. It's based on a true story. A book was written about this guy who did not have puberty until age 30. They found a benign tumor resting on his pituitary gland. And he was 30 years old, and finally he had an answer as to why he never went through puberty. And because he had no sex drive or desire, he was fully developed as an adult man at that age, 30, in every other effect. So because he had no sex drive of any kind, he accomplished way more.
He's happier.
And it was a fascinating story. In fact, it's a high concept comedy that the second act begins with him getting puberty. And all the ridiculousness of a 30-year-old man going through what a 12-year-old boy would go through. But the fact that the high concept had a true story behind it, that it was based on in a book, just made it a godsend. I mean, so yeah, it's called Late Bloomer, and we just started the casting process, and I'm unbelievably excited. I'm supposed to be in front of the camera, or rather behind the camera, pointing the camera is what I meant to say. The end of June.
Nice.
Wow.
Yeah, quick, fast.
Yeah.
I was waiting for him to say like next week. I'm like, yeah. Jesus Christ.
But still, that's really quick. It might as well.
Casting immediately is.
Oh, yeah.
He's actually looking at us like, who's sexually dysfunctional? You, sir, stay over after this.
Yeah, his voice starts to
Yeah.
Acne comes, of course. And...
So you're saying it's just what happens to me now?
Yeah.
When I talk to girls. Yeah. Thanks for stealing my story.
Sorry, man.
You were trying to answer the question technically with the movie, of course, but I'm just wondering where the flip side of it comes around, where how we as an audience fit into it for finding joy out of maybe somebody's misery. Is that something that ever goes through an entertainer's mind?
That the public at large finds joy in misery?
Yeah. Well, finds it in their misery.
Yeah, well, it's slipping on the banana peel, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, that's as base as it comes. Silent movies, comedians were born on the knowledge, not the notion, that we love. In fact, all of reality TV is just this.
Yeah.
So, since we sit in judgment, as a people, the comedian will take advantage of that and purposely be the fool to elicit that laughter. So. Was the question, was I counting on it, or?
Well, I guess, does it ever become a point of contention, I guess? Like, does it feel strange that, still knowing that we're finding joy out of it?
No, I think it's the same way that misery is the human condition. We'll always, also, it's very human to enjoy misery of others, and I think that's just the base saying, misery loves company. Hmm. So, yeah. It's a given. And then I think for the comedian or the screenwriter or the songwriter or the painter or any artist, you just have to figure out a way to articulate the misery so that it's entertaining or enlightening. But a painter works in a vacuum and then sends it out and might not necessarily need the attention that the performer needs. In the film, one of the few times also that you hear me speak is when I need to point out the "Hey, look at me" disease.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that I was the first to call it a disease, but it is one. Children suffer from it because they're children.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yeah.
But really, organically, what that means is for food, for please remove the shit from my ass,
no.
From, you know.
Keep me alive.
It's genuine, organic need for attention. Then they realize, shortly thereafter, to manipulate mm-hmm. by crying, I can get picked up and held. Mm-hmm. I like the way that feels. Where the hell is that nipple? And it slowly becomes a little more self-serving when you are fully aware, just as aware you are, that life ends for everyone. And when that happens for a child, you are aware that if you do this or that, it will elicit attention. All right, great. But then I make the argument that adults clearly suffer from "Hey, look at me" disease. Otherwise, Facebook isn't a multi-billion-dollar business.
Right.
You're not someone until you have a page. I don't know about you guys, but sometimes do you write a description of people in order to remember who they are? So
yep.
This literally says, gambling movie guy.
Turned out to be John Goodman.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wanted to say those words to elicit conversation about the "Hey, look at me" aspect to it. And if we don't know the audience wants us to slip on the banana, then we're not going to slip on the banana. You know, you can do it once on accident when no one's around to, you know, shortly thereafter realize I was humiliated and embarrassed and felt horrible is the human reaction to that. And then those of us that choose comedy shortly thereafter realize how to manipulate that and recreate it. I still get embarrassed and horrified by, you know, doing something I didn't intend. That part of it never goes away. But it's the knowledge and awareness and the effort to harness that reaction that becomes part of my livelihood and creative. Why I would put gambling movie guy in my phone, I think there may be an audience.
You mean you're not just doing Peter Falk in the mirror for yourself?
No, I can't do it in the mirror because I cross one of my eyes. I can't see it.
It might kill you, actually.
Well, you know, it's very difficult to actually see what this looks like.
All right, I can die now.
So you know what he said to me when I finally ran into him? Mm-hmm. After doing that on The Tonight Show with Carson, I ran to Peter Falk, and he said, "How do you do that with your eyes?" No, me, I understand, but how do you do that? And as a kid, I remember reading in TV Guide magazine, when Columbo was on the air, that Peter Falk, in the TV Guide article, spoke openly about having a glass eye from the age of 3, and he gave two examples of how it served him well. One was, he was in class, the teacher had to leave and put Peter in charge of the class. And the moment the teacher left and he was at her desk, the kids started misbehaving wildly. And he just got fed up and took out his eye, put it on the table and said, "I'm going to go now. Just realize when I'm gone, I'll have an eye on you." And then, playing Little League, he slid to second base, called him out, took out his eye, handed it to him and said, "You clearly need this more than I do."
Oh my God.
So I thought if he was that open about it, it took the onus off all of us staring. And then I could teach myself how to cross one eye and not feel so bad. And then when he's commented on it, it was the ultimate not feel so bad.
Yeah.
Anything else for the website?
No, you're doing well.
Thank you.
You're doing very well.
Thank you.
I'll throw something out there then. You've also talked about it a few times already, but since most of your, if not all of your subjects, know you personally or well from the business, did you feel like you were kind of, I don't want to say poisoning the well a little bit, but it would have been different if somebody else is behind asking the questions?
So what is the question?
Basically, if you felt that maybe being so familiar with your subjects changed maybe some of their reactions.
There was too much positive to gain from them being comfortable with me to worry or factor in the name, to be honest with you. I never stopped and thought about that because that's just not part of my thought process. Or as a first-time filmmaker, you know, I knew this was a serious subject, and that I, in editing, decided to cut it as a comedy. Because funny people can't help but be funny while they're talking about misery. But at no point did I see a deficit from they're too familiar with me. Again, drawing from the chat show experience and booking that and getting, figuring out when during the conversation to make it a little more pointed. How long does it take to relax people, loosen their sphincter, to speak openly and honestly? That was so important that I'm using that, I guess, as a rationale as to why I never stopped and thought, well, if they're too familiar with me, it might be detrimental to the truth, I think. Yeah, I mean, I think if the interviewer in this particular topic was not someone who had suffered similarly or experienced similarly, then you're not going to elicit the similar conversation, or similar-based conversation. But because of that objectivity, you may get, ultimately, a better film, if that indeed is the thesis behind your question. Was there a better film possible?
No, not that, no. Definitely not.
Yeah, no.
The answer is yes.
But part of it.
Here comes the misery part.
Yeah. Yes, there was and is a better film possible. This was just the one I could do. Yeah.
Jonah Hill's going to be the late bloomer, right? That's what we're...
No.
He's like, don't joke.
No, he's not.
Was there anyone who broke the mold and was just like genuinely happy and didn't have a miserable story to tell at all?
Yeah, I mean, one of the great things for me in the discovery of the subject matter was not everyone is miserable. Not everyone needs to have misery constantly in their life to fuel their artistry. The task is to articulate the misery, the human condition. There's no way to avoid misery in one's life. So I think it's on any artist to figure out their own point of view and their own voice to articulate it. So along the way, there were people that were quite surprising and overwhelming, you know, with their particular take on it. Did that specifically to your question? Yeah, okay.
Last question.
I wasn't sure if I got specifically to
No, that's perfect, thank you.
Okay.
Well then, was it the exact opposite? Was it somebody who was a little more kind of like a brick wall that you didn't get anything out of that you were hoping for?
All the brick wall moments are on the cutting room floor. You know, I mean, they're bound to happen. Either I didn't ask them in the right way that elicited the response I wanted, or they weren't comfortable going there, if that's still a term people use.
Well, you went there.
There were a couple of stiffs along the way. Stiff moments, not people. But with 70 hours, it was easy to navigate. Yeah, I mean, there was just a wealth of honesty and experience and humanity and humor. One of the analogies I make is the first Iron Man movie. So what Favreau and RDJ were able to accomplish that I think set the entire multi-billion-dollar conglomerate that is Marvel movies is capturing humanity and humor in the character of Iron Man. So his charm comes from his humanity and humor when he's talking to the pieces that help robotic machines that help him build the suit. You know, there's a sense of genuine humanity and humor in that character, so that we just dial right in to that world and that life as opposed to a comic book. You know, I remember the first Avengers movie when that Chinese New Year dragon thing. I don't feel any stakes. I don't feel any threat. I don't care that people are smashing into buildings. So, what on a huge scale like that, or on a tiny scale like this, where it's just talking heads, I was really looking for the humor and the humanity at all times.
Awesome.